and become country wet, because it is the kind of experience that we need, and we need so desperately in the black church and in the black community today. Let me begin by saying that I came to talk with you and not at you. I came to help you to clarify an experience in which you are very deeply immersed. That is to say, the black church. The black church with all its implications for your future and for your satisfaction, I guess would be a good way of putting it. I suppose that a good way to launch into what I want to say tonight is to tell you a little bit more about myself, and not out of a spirit of self-aggrandizement, but because I am one of you. And I see people out there who represent myself just a few years ago, people who are struggling to achieve and to attain, who may not be absolutely convinced that it's worth time and that it's worthwhile. I share with you some personal things about myself to help you to believe even more firmly in yourselves. I come from Alabama, very small town in North Alabama. I never knew my father. I was reared by my grandmother. Does that sound familiar to some of you? I was reared by my grandmother. In the town in which I grew up, there was no city or county high school for black people. As far as the city and the county were concerned, education ended at the sixth grade for anybody who was black, and the school year was 7 months, not nine. Except for the fact that there was a missionary school run by the American Missionary Association, some good white Congregationalists out of New England, I would never have received any kind of an education worthy of the name. But because God is good and because God sees beyond the present, I got at Trinity School, this missionary school, an education that was far better than anything I could have gotten in the county or city schools that were there for white people. At 15, just before I was 15, I left Alabama, and at 15 I was a student at the University of Chicago. And off and on, as God would have it, and as the money came and went, I was in and out of school for the next millennium, so to speak. And not I studied sociology, but because I studied history, I studied philosophy, I studied law, and finally I studied religion. I have 5.5 earned degrees in these various subjects, and I have been graced and blessed by any number of honorary degrees since then. The highest tribute that has been paid to me, and again I mention this not out of any attempt to promote myself, is that I have been called the Dean of Black Religious Studies. And why is that important to me? It is important because I have had a strong hand in the creation of such luminaries that you know, such as James Cone, such as Gayrod Wilmore, such as Henry Mitchell, such as Bill Jones, right on down the line. I took Jim Cone, for example, whom I understand who has lectured here, almost literally out of nowhere, brought him to the publication of his first book, brought him to Union Seminary, where he became a protege of mine, and of course he went on to do great things for you. Great things for you. Because Jim Cone was the one person most responsible for including black people, in the theological perspectives which we attribute to God. We had been here in this country all these hundreds of years, and all of the theology we ever knew was theology that came from another perspective, theology that was Eurocentric, theology that never had any explanation for God's relationship, if any, with black people. Jim Cone changed all that. And I hope that you will never forget it, and so on. But my own sense of responsibility led me to deliberately set out to do essentially what I have done, or certainly tried to do, and that is to create a literature, an authentic literature, on the black church and black religion. You see, when I was a student in the Divinity School at the University of Chicago, and later when I was a student in the seminary at Boston University, the black church as such did not exist. It was there, yes. There were thousands of black churches all over the country, thousands of black ministers and so on. But so far as the literature that we were studying in the seminaries was concerned, the black church did not exist. When it was mentioned at all, the reference was made to those Negro sects, and that dismissed it. That was all. When any consideration was given to the black clergy, it was a derisive consideration. We went to the white seminaries to learn that all black ministers were charlatans, that all black ministers were jacklegs, that all black ministers would steal the money and run. In other words, the black church was a charade, and that people who were seriously studying for the ministry ought not to spend their time dealing with anything like that. And unfortunately, some of the few scholars we had at the time who knew better, or who should have known better, had been either so brainwashed by the professors in the traditional seminaries that they were afraid to say what they knew to be true. And so one of my earliest books was called The Black Church Since Frazier. Why was I titling the book The Black Church Since Frazier? Because E. Franklin Frazier, with all his learning and erudition, had adopted the notion that the black church stood in the way of Negro progress, that because it attempted to separate itself out of the religious mainstream, as he put it, that it was a barrier to anything good. This was the burden of the lectures that Frazier gave at Oxford back in the 1940s. And this was my point of departure. What I tried to say in the Black Church since Frazier was that Frazier was talking about an entity that I knew naught of. He was talking about a Negro church, but I was talking about the emergence of a Black church, a church which was its own authenticity, a church which made no attempt to be the white church in blackface. That is how the Black church was looked upon all these years, as a very poor attempt to be the white church, and a failing attempt at that. It was my finding and my teaching that the Black church was its own legitimacy, its own authenticity, that it had no necessity of finding its legitimation in the white church, because the white church, among other things, had some very, very dirty fringes to the garment that it wore. So then, the Black church could and did develop of itself, of its own legitimacy, of its own peculiar relationship with God. When I was in seminary, it was given us to understand that all we knew about religion came as a gift from the Anglo-Saxons. That is patently untrue. As a matter of fact, I never understood why Black people didn't bother to read their Bibles, particularly the book of Acts, where it is said that at the very beginning of the Black church, somewhere around chapters 3 or 4, that there were devout men from every nation under heaven gathered in this upper room, you remember, after Jesus had risen, and that they came from every nation under heaven, that they spoke to each other in tongues that were previously unknown to each other. What? And then, because God is wise, and because he looked down the years and saw that 2,000 years later, people would say there were no Africans there, the book of Acts names several African countries who were present at the day the church was born, which is the day of Pentecost following the resurrection of Jesus. And then, as if to anticipate that there would still be some Black folk who were unconvinced that they were there, God sent an angel to the Apostle Philip on day 2. Philip was there in Jerusalem. The angel appeared unto Philip and said, get up and put on your shoes and take the back road out of the gate and head down toward Gaza, because God has something there for you to do. Philip did as he was told, and after he got out on the road, he saw pulled up on the shoulder of the highway the chariot. You are preachers, you remember that. And there in the chariot stood, according to the book of Acts, a high-born Ethiopian eunuch who was treasurer to Queen Candace, Candace. Candace is a generic term which means, in effect, royal queen or something like that. And the reference was to an Ethiopian who was her treasurer. Dr. Smith can tell you immediately that Ethiopian was a generic term in the Bible which referred to anybody black. You are to me as the Ethiopians, et cetera, et cetera. There was a country of Ethiopians, and there were black people in that country. But generically, the term Ethiopian was used to refer to anyone who was black. So in all probability, Queen Candace, or Queen Candacra, as she might have been called, was the queen of Nubia, which is now the Sudan, which is right next to Egypt, south of Egypt, a black country. But at any rate, here is the Ethiopian in his chariot, and Philip draws nigh to him, says the book of Acts, and says, "What are you doing?" The Ethiopian says, "I am trying to make sense of the book of Isaiah that I am reading here." And Philip says, "Do you understand it?" And the Ethiopian says, "How can I when there's no man to teach me?" And so then Philip said to him, "Well, look, I know something about Isaiah. Maybe I can help you." He gets into the chariot with the Ethiopian, reads and interprets the book of Isaiah to him. And in the course of their little friendly get-together, Philip begins to tell the Ethiopian what has happened yesterday in Jerusalem. The church was born. There's a great confraternity of people who follow the risen Christ yesterday. And the Ethiopian said, "My Lord, what do I have to do to be a member of that great confraternity?" And Philip says, "Well, truly, all you have to do is to believe and to be baptized." And this is the book of Acts, folks. And the Ethiopian said, "Truly, I believe. Look, there is some water. Baptize me now." Day two. You were there. Day two. All right. In 313 A.D., the Roman Emperor Constantine was converted to Christianity. You will recall that before that time, all of the Christians were subject to being fed to the lions or being killed by gladiators. They had to live in the catacombs and tombs under the streets of Rome and so on. So to be Christian was a very hazardous business. You remember Saul, who was a Jew and who delighted in getting together with the yuppies and buffies of his day to travel out to Damascus to bring back the Christians bound in chains so that they could be punished and persecuted in Jerusalem. You also remember that on one of those such trips, God slapped the hell out of Paul, and he lay in the street, blinded, wondering what had happened, and God's voice came and said, "You know, Saul, why are you persecuting me? These are my folk and so on." But that's another story. The story that I want to continue with is that Constantine put an end to all that when he became Christian. The year was 313 A.D. 327 A.D., Christianity reached the country of Ethiopia, which thereafter became Christian. Now, Christianity did not reach the British Isles for several centuries later than that. So you didn't have to wait for the British, the Anglo-Saxons, to come to America to teach you Christianity. You already know it. You were already part of it. So the black church takes its departure, as does any other church, from the day of Pentecost, the day of Pentecost following the resurrection of Jesus. It is true that because of the peculiarities of the slave experience, there was an interaction between the Anglo-Saxons and the Africans in this country, which gave rise to the misunderstanding that black religion was dependent from the beginning upon Anglo-Saxon conversion. That was absolutely not the case. Let's take a look at the African experience in this country, which antedates the Anglo-Saxon experience by at least 150 years. You recall the title of Lerone Bennett's book, Before the Mayflower? It isn't just incidental. Lerone was documenting, and documenting correctly, the fact that Africans were in this country long before the Mayflower. Certainly, lots of them came with the Spanish. They may have come before the Spanish. That we cannot prove. But there are legitimate theories that Africans taking sail from the west coast of Africa reached South America centuries before Columbus did. But that we don't know. What we do know is that the navigator of Columbus's flagship, the Nina, was an African whose name was Pedro de la Nina, and that large numbers of so-called blackamoors, which is to say black Muslims, came with the subsequent Spanish expeditions to South America, to Central America, to the southwestern part of the United States, long before the British came to Plymouth Rock or before they came to Jamestown. As a matter of fact, the first wheat crop planted in this country, planted in what is now Colorado, was planted by an African with the Spanish expedition. His name was Estevanico, Little Stephen, so to speak. But there are many, many such instances as that. Some of you who come from Florida know about the city of St. Augustine, which is the oldest city in the United States, built by the Spanish and the Africans in 1525. 1525, that's a long time before 1619. We usually associate the African experience with the point at which it converges with the Anglo-Saxon experience. That comes about in this way. The Anglo-Saxons had a settlement at Jamestown, Virginia, and in 1619, August the 12th, about 2:30 in the afternoon, a certain ship put into the harbor there. And this ship was had on board 20 Africans, 20 Negars, as the manifest said. It was under Dutch command. The Dutch had taken these Africans from a Portuguese slaver. But they had run out of provisions, so they put into Jamestown and offered to exchange the Africans, the Negars, for food and water so they could go on about their business. The colonists at Jamestown made the exchange, and these 20 Africans became members of the Jamestown colony. The big question that immediately rushes to the ordinary mind is, were they slaves? No, they were not slaves. You see, the institution of slavery had not yet developed in America, but an institution of semi-slavery called indenture was developing at that time. What is the difference? Well, indenture was a legal device developed that permitted the sea captains who sailed back and forth between England and the United States to buy up the time of people who were held in prison, particularly the London jail, buy up their time, pay their fines, and they thereafter belonged to the captain. Many other people were brought from Ireland, people who were poor and desperate, who sold themselves into indenture. Another source for indentured servants was, you've seen the romanization of this in the movies, the sea captains and their crew roaming the streets of London and Bristol late at night would simply capture anybody who was out late at night, take them aboard ship. When they brought those people, however they came by them, to the United States, they sold them to the planters. There was a labor shortage. They sold them to the planters. The arrangement was that any servant taken into indenture could be sold until he had worked off the price of his indenture, usually 7 years. 7 years. After 7 years, according to British law, he must go free. All right? That was the system in which these 20 Negroes were undoubtedly placed, at least for a time. We know that they were not enslaved because at least two of them were married in the Episcopal Church there in Jamestown, and that would have been impossible, and that they had a son who was recorded in the church records, which still exists there today, whose name was Punch. It was not until the 1660s, some 40 or 50 years later, that the institutionalization of African slavery became fixed in America, and it came about in this way. Indentured servants were indentured servants, whatever their race. America was not at that time a society based on race, it was a society based on class. You had the planter class, you had the business class, you had the indentured servants class. Generally speaking, there was no class intermixture between the two upper classes and the indentured servants, of course. But the indentured servants, there was no wall separating them so far as color was concerned, so intermarriage was the common thing, particularly because of the fact that most of the Africans who were now being brought in from Africa were male, and very many of the Irish particularly were women, so they intermarried. Nobody thought anything about that until greed crept into the picture. By and by, some planter decided that he could, if he wanted to, keep an indentured servant in indenture as long as he wanted to. So it turned out, though, that those who had come from England or Ireland, who were under the sovereignty of the British Crown, could write back to their relatives in England or Ireland, complain to the Crown. The Crown would then see that they got relief through the governors of the colony. In other words, you're still a British citizen, even though you are in indenture. And the governor of the colony can come to your relief and make the planters do the right thing. It also became apparent after some time that the indentured servants from Africa could not write to any recognized sovereign in Africa, any sovereign that was recognized by the planters, to demand any relief for them. So it became the custom, and here is where African slavery in the United States became institutionalized, it became the custom to hold European servants for a term of years, 7 years. And it became the custom to hold African servants dura vita, which is to say, for life, because there is nothing that they can do about it. Then, the next step along this line was occurred because of the fact that according to English law, the line of descent follows the father, which is to say the civil status of the father will be the civil status of the child, which again is to say that if the father is a slave, the child must be a slave. So then, it became clear that if you forced marriage between African males and English or Irish girls, then all of the issue born to that marriage following the line of the father would be slaves. So then, whereas before there had been intermarriage that came at the initiation of the parties concerned, now it became popular to force marriage between particularly Irish women and African males in order that the children born of that marriage would follow the line of the father and would therefore be slaves. Around 1660, two states, Maryland and North Carolina, changed the law in order to try to get rid of this pernicious policy. They changed the law and declared that thereafter the line of descent would follow the mother, and so that the children would have the legal status of the mother. It didn't make any difference. The practice still went on. So it was thereafter, in the late 1660s, that all of the southern states or colonies declared that thereafter it would be absolutely illegal for there to be any intermarriage between the races. I make this long point of digression because I want you to understand that the first miscegenation laws came not in any attempt to keep white people and black people from marrying each other, but they came in an attempt to prevent the abuse of marriage. It was an economic factor and not a social factor, and that becomes very important later when we talk about the development of the African experience in this church. Now, in the meantime, what was going on with the Africans here, religiously speaking? Not a great deal. It was a primary element of slave management to disperse from the beginning all Africans who had come from the same village or community, who spoke the same language, who had the same religion, or whatever, as a protection against the possibility of insurrection. So if you were Igbo, for example, or if you were Yoruba, or if you were Ashanti, then it was prudent slave management to place one Ashanti over here with an Igbo and one Yoruba in the same pot, because they didn't even speak each other's language. And they would have a difficult time, or certainly you could expect it to take years before they would be close enough to mount an insurrection. So you spread them out. That meant, among other things, that there was no religious cultus available. Religion requires a cultus. It requires a body of people who are of the same mind and who are of the same spirit to participate with each other, not only in the promulgation of the faith, but in the celebration of the faith. That is why we put such great emphasis upon the congregation. The congregation is nothing more or less than a cultus of people who are of like mind, like spirit, who are interested in the same kind of an experience. But if you have got people from a dozen societies, a dozen tribes together, how can they worship? They can't. Another factor was that the African slaves were, for the most part, those who were imported were for the most part men. And it is the woman who is the culture bearer, if you please. It is the woman who, to this day, is more likely to be involved in teaching the children, in remembering and honoring the old ways and traditions and so on, while the men go and do something else. So then, this was another blow against the possibility of religious transition from Africa to this country. But of course, the greatest barrier was the intentional separation because of the theory that the African was brought here to work, not to worship. And so that was their primary reason for being here. So as time went on, people raised many, many questions about bringing the Africans to Christ, and the answer was always no. And the reasons given ran the gamut of the imagination. I would just mention one or two of them. It was thought, for example, it was not only thought, it was taught that in the first place, the Africans were a subhuman species, and that even though they looked like men, meaning Europeans, to some degree, although they were discolored, they lacked certain capacities that were always present in true human beings. One of the capacities was a developed brain. It was argued that the African had a truncated mentality, and that because he had, it was a waste of time to try to teach him anything as complicated as Christianity. Also, because he was subhuman, he was, of course, incapable of even approaching the moral behavior required of Christians. In short, the African was something between a child and an animal. We get good indication of this line of thinking by the institutionalization of certain forms of address that remained with us until just yesterday. Africans were never referred to as men and women. They were referred to as boy, girl, which is to say that you will never grow up, you have an arrested development. And they were never referred to in the press as Mr. or Mrs. because those were titles which implied maturity. You don't call a child Mr. You don't call a child Mrs. Mrs., Mr. are titles which imply the recognition of maturity and responsibility. Since black folk could never attain to that level, they were never referred to as Mr. and Mrs. until in your own time. Now, it was also thought that if the Africans were brought to Christ, that they would become uppity and unmanageable. And I remember almost verbatim an objection that was raised by an Episcopalian lady in Virginia, around 1840. She said, when her pastor broached the subject, she said, and I quote, "What? Those black dogs? And shall they be like us? And when I get to heaven, must I be inconvenienced by them there?" Well, she didn't have to worry because it has been said that everybody talking about heaven ain't going there anyway. But at any rate, these were some of the reasons given. Blacks were not permitted to attempt to practice whatever religions they knew in Africa. And one of the precautions against this was that they took away the drums. Now, those of you who are from Africa, and I just met one of you, know that religion in Africa is not a once-a-week thing. It is a part of your total approach to reality. You get up in the morning being religious, just as you get up being human. And a part of the celebration of religion revolves around the use of the drum, the dance, and so on and so on and so on. It would be as difficult for an African to properly worship without a drum as it would be for, let us say, a Roman Catholic to worship without his beads and his crucifix or his vestments and so on. This is a part of the paraphernalia of worship, the means by which the believer comes into personal contact with his God. The drums were forbidden. I can recall my great-grandmother still grumbling when I was a little kid about the fact that they took away our drums. They took our drums away from us. I didn't know what she was talking about, but I must have found out later. Took our drums away from us, and that is like taking away your Bible, whatever, because they have taken away a key instrument that was used in getting together with the divine, with the Almighty. So it went. So for the first 100 years, approximately, there was no sustained effort, and certainly no organized effort, to bring the Africans in this country to Christ. It was not until the advent of the Society for the Propagation of the Gospel in Foreign Parts, which was popularly known as the SPG, sent 40 missionaries to this country from England in 1701. Those missionaries had two stated responsibilities. One was to try to deal with the Episcopalians in the Tidewater states, Virginia, Carolina, and so on, who, because they refused to recognize the jurisdiction of an English bishop, were in effect doing their own thing. And the literature of complaint had such words as that the Episcopalians were gaming and whoring and, you know, doing a lot of things that were to the distress of the church. So it was thought that these missionaries might persuade them to hew more closely to the official expectations of the Church of England. But the missionaries were readily rebuffed by the vestrymen of these churches, who enjoyed the power that they themselves had, who enjoyed the life. Then turned to their second mission, which was to attempt to missionize certain Indians who were thought now to be sufficiently pacified that they might be brought to Christ. But again, they ran into a rebuff. The Indians said, in effect, you have your God, we have our God. We like our God, take your God away. And so there you had 40 ardent, insistent Christian missionaries in this country with nobody to missionize. What do you do when you got 40 missionaries and you can't give them to anybody? Well, the missionaries decided that they would go after the slaves. The slave owner said, absolutely not. We don't want you tampering with our Negroes for all of the reasons that I have given and some others. The Bishop of London then issued a bull, an edict, that said that in no case shall, well, before I divulge this bull, there was a tradition in England, I underscore, where any slave who converted to Christianity must be freed, because the English felt it inappropriate to hold a fellow Christian in slavery. Nowhere in this country, as far as I have been able to find in 40 years of research, did that ever happen to a slave in this country. But Christians do some strange things. There are a number of instances in which white congregations bought slaves who were preachers in order that they might preach to them and be their pastor. But for a slave to be freed, manumitted, because he became a Christian, was not a part of the American tradition. So the Bishop of London eventually issued a bull which said that in no case shall conversion work manumission, but that each of ye Negroes that are brought to Christ will remain in the same civil state as he was before converting to Christ, because God is interested in his soul and not his body. The planters still said no. And it was not until the sense of this edict was codified into colonial law that the planters began to reluctantly experiment with having their slaves, or some of them, exhorted or preached to. They finally agreed to this experiment because it was argued that a Christianized slave who had been brought to Christ, would have the total interest of his master always before him. that because he was Christian, he would stop lying, stealing, and malingering, and would make the protection of his master and mistress the reason for his existence, because it was taught that the slaves from Africa had been given great privilege merely to be in the presence of the white Christians, that merely by being in their presence they would someday come out of the darkness of savagery and become people. So the argument ran. Now, in time, a few planters began to permit the missionaries to gather the house slaves, under the magnolias around the big house compound, and preach to them on Sunday afternoon. And this is what I call, in some of my writing, the Magnolia Mission. The only slaves who could attend were those slaves who were directly associated with the big house. The mammies, the cooks, the valets, the wet nurses, perhaps the gardener, the groom, and so on. Those people who were in constant attendance upon the master and the mistress. Sometimes when the missionaries, who may come once a month or once every 2 months, couldn't make it, the mistress, I don't know why, it was seldom the master, but the mistress might read to them from the Bible and might help them to understand what it was that God wanted them to do. Out of that tradition, another step was made. By and by, it became the custom for the master and the mistress to take their favorite slaves to church with them. Again, we are talking about the body servants, the valets, the nurses, and so on. Take them to church with them. None of these privileges were ever extended to the field slaves. If you can visualize a plantation, which, if it were a very large plantation, may have 2,000 or 3,000 slaves, then you can easily see why. Typically, the field slaves had no contact with anybody white except the overseer. They lived a totally different kind of life, and they developed a totally different tradition, which was later to become a thorn in the side of the black church, still is, for that matter. But at any rate, we now have the house slaves being taken to church, where they are required to sit around the perimeter of the sanctuary. They were under the close watch of the church warden. The church warden's duty was to make sure that nobody nodded or went to sleep, that nobody screamed, that nobody shouted, that nobody said amen, that nobody behaved indecorously in any way. You sat there and you listened, and when it was over, you went out. And the sermon that you listened to was typically right out of Paul, right out of Pauline doctrine, as it was called. Servants, obey your masters. Servants, obey your masters, because they have been set over you in the place of God himself. And any harm that you do your masters, or any malfeasance towards your masters or your mistress, is the same as a malfeasance against God, and you will rot in eternal damnation. This was the sermon preached to the slaves. They were not permitted to commune with the white congregants. Occasionally, a benign minister would provide communion for the slaves after church was over and the whites had all left the building. The numbers began to increase, and eventually the slaves were required to sit in the far rear of the sanctuary in pews that was provided for them, that were provided for them. And in many churches, a latticework screen was built to separate the blacks from the whites. And the blacks sitting in the rear of the church could peep through the screen and see and could hear the minister. But the notion of physical separation, the notion of social distance, was, of course, driven home by the fact of this barrier, this wooden barrier that separated the races. Still more black people began to come to church, and they became a problem. And the resolution of that problem was an interesting one, and I will share it with you by reciting almost verbatim, very nearly verbatim, anyway, the minutes from the Goose Creek Presbytery in South Carolina, which met in the summer of 1836. The minutes read something like this. We did permit our Negroes to enter our sanctuary, and they were seated on the walls. And when their numbers became too great for this, we did require them to sit in the rear of the sanctuary under watch charge. And when their numbers became inconvenient for this, we did build for them a gallery in the rear of the church above the back pews, and they were required to sit there. I want to pause for a moment on that gallery, because inevitably that gallery came to be known as Nigger Heaven. Nigger Heaven, way up under the rafters in the back of the church. Most of you have never been in a Nigger Heaven in a church, but I suspect that there are still a few of you out there who have been in the counterpart Nigger Heaven. Because when I was growing up in the South, Nigger Heaven referred to that gallery away up under the roof of the local movie house. And in order to get up there, you had to go through an alley and up the back stairs, and you were so far up and so far away from the stage until Hoot Mix or Tim McCoy or all the cowboys you were trying to see looked like little bugs running across the screen. That came to be called Nigger Heaven. But so far as the church is concerned, those of you who are from the South, next time you go home, take a look at some of the older white churches there, because those galleries are still there in many cases. The minutes that I was citing went on to conclude that after they had put the blacks in the gallery, and again, I quote, when their numbers became too great for this arrangement, they were required to catch the gospel as it escaped from the windows and the doors. In other words, they were put outside. Now, at the same time that blacks were having this experience in the white church, the big house slaves were having this experience in the white church. There was developing an underground church, a church that came to be called the Invisible Institution. The underground church was a church that was peopled by the field slaves. And it worked something like this. Usually the slave work ended late Saturday afternoon, after which the slave was given time to tend his little garden plot and to rest a little bit so that on Monday he would be ready to meet that, as my grandmother used to call that old four-day horn. That four-day horn was dialect for the horn that blew before daylight. Actually, it blew 15 minutes before sunrise, and when it blew the second time at sunrise, if you were not out into the road with your hoe or your plow ready to go to the fields, then you were in a great deal of trouble. So slaves had great, great distaste for that four-day horn. Now, Saturday afternoon, all the work on most plantations ceased, and slaves had a little bit of time off. The field slaves, who had never had an opportunity to become socialized in the white man's church, developed their own church. Down in the swamps and the bayous, as far away from the big house as they were able to get, because if they were found in such a church meeting, it meant 39 stripes with the whip the first time. It meant whipping and branding the second time. And it usually meant being sold down the river the third time. So then, they had to be very careful and very discreet. Now, since they were going to be gone over the weekend, so to speak, of course they had to eat. So it became the practice for someone to take a shoat or two from the white man's pigsty. I know you don't know what a shoat is because all of you are city folk. But a shoat is a young pig which has been neutered in order to stop it from fighting other male pigs and in order to make the meat sweet and tender and so on. So you take this shoat from the master's sty and put him in a croaker sack, take him down into the woods. And please note that I say take, because that is important too in understanding our traditions and experiences. You took from the master. You couldn't possibly steal from the master, because everything the master owned you had produced. So you were taking back what was yours. You took from the master. Now, if you laid your hand on something of some other slave, that was stealing, pure and simple. But you took from the master. And that goes very deeply into our traditional understandings to this day. If you read the literature of slavery, you would be amazed at the stereotype that always pictured the slave as lying and stealing, lying and stealing. If you understand the situation, then you will see the slave as doing whatever was necessary to survive, to survive. Why should he tell the truth to somebody who was going to persecute him for it? That didn't make any kind of sense. So that wasn't lying. I told boss a story. Yeah, it was a story. And so far as stealing, how could you steal what's yours? Okay, but anyway, we got the show. We got him in the bag. We take him down to the woods. You're going to have to cook him. If you build a big bonfire, then your location will be given away. But if you brought along some of the charcoal, the oak chips and the hickory chips from the forge and the blacksmith shop, and you dug a hole in the ground, you fired these coals from the ground, no smoke of any consequence. So then you go and you lop off some sassafras branches because of the sweet, pungent smell of the sassafras. Again, I regret that more of you have not had the rural experience that I have, but at any rate, you chop off these branches, and they smell so good. You lay them on this pit that you dug in the ground, and you have already dressed this shoat. You lay him on the sassafras branches over the coals. And while he is roasting, you get some member of the group who knows something about yarps, that is to say herbs, and he or she goes looking along the creek banks and finds the grasses and the spices and so on, which she will boil and make a sauce. And what you got? Presto, you got barbecue. So it has always been interesting to me, these little footnotes to our history. You know, I dare say that you don't know any black Christian who is truly Christian who can't barbecue. That is where the tradition comes from. The two go together. Now, in the underground church, in the clandestine church, in the invisible church, you're going to have a distinctly different style of worship from what is going on in the white man's church. Gathered there are people whose whole lives are devoted to one enterprise. Now we call that enterprise from kin to kin. From kin see in the morning to can't see at night. Your life is spent in the fields, working not for any earthly reward that you will ever receive, working for somebody else. If your head aches, you work anyway. If your back aches, you work anyway. If your child has been sold away from you, you work anyway. If your husband, if your consort has died, you work anyway. When you get down there and get ready to worship God, you want to tell him all about it. You want to tell God all your troubles because nobody else is interested in them. And you are pent up with emotion that has been under control for a whole week. The overseer has lashed you or lashed somebody you know. You can't lash the overseer. You have got all kinds of pains and troubles. You can't talk about them. But when you come before God down in the woods, you can tell him. You can scream. You can shout. You can moan, you can preach, you can pray until the earth reverberates, if you will. So we get a different kind of tradition. Now, speaking of screaming and shouting, if you shout too loud, if you preach too loud, then you might bring the man down on you. But they had a device for that too. You take along the big iron wash pot that you wash the master's clothes in, that you boil the clothes in. You turn the pot upside down on the ground. You put a rock under the edge of it. And though I'm not an acoustical engineer, I'm told that all the sound went into the pot. And nobody was detected. All right, so this is the underground church. It is pastored by somebody who probably couldn't read the Bible, but who had a good memory and into whose mouth God put his own words. And he preached. And there, out of that comes the tradition that is very strong in the black church to this day. You don't have to have a PhD to speak the word. God will give you the words to say, just as he did your slave fathers who couldn't read, who were not permitted to read. So then you find an awful lot of black people who believe that the critical thing is to be called of God rather than to be educated. And though as the culture changes, this tradition will change too. But appreciated for what it was at a time when you could do no better. Who could read? You couldn't, because you didn't have the opportunity. At any rate, nevertheless, there was to come a time when these two traditions must be brought together. The Civil War is fought. The Africans are freed. The black church has to be established for all people. You have the strand of worshipers who are relatively small in number, who have been socialized in the white church. You have the vast multitude of field people who have had their religious experience in the fields. You have to merge those two, because Christianity is one, and certainly black Christians had better be one, or they will be sorry if they aren't. So you have to merge those traditions. But we are creatures of culture, so even today we spend a lot of time, too much time really, fighting about whether we're going to sing the anthems of Martin Luther, or whether we are going to sing the songs that we ourselves invented, or whether we are going to be silent and decorous and to look intelligent, or whether we are going to give vent to the emotions that create turmoil inside of us. Well, I'll leave that to the ministers and to the deacons and to the church brothers to decide. I'm going to stay out of that one. I've already spoken too long, but there is so much that you need to know about your history and how it came to be the way it is, that I wish sometimes that I had all of you, had a chance to speak to all of you in an extended length of time. But I do want to say this very quickly. I want to talk about the book that we published last year, The Black Church and the African American Experience, which was 12 years in the making, which represents, we think, and certainly it has been said, the best that there is in the understanding of the African experience in religion, which was given 3 pages in Time magazine when it came out last November, and which was given the first 2 pages in the New York Times Books Review, and which tomorrow will be given the Distinguished Award of the Society for the Scientific Study of Religion, which is about as high as you can go, tomorrow in Pittsburgh. The book deals with the 7 major black denominations, which I had intended to etch into this talk. The 3 major Baptist denominations, the 3 major Methodist denominations, and the Church of God in Christ. it talks about how all these denominations came into being. It talks about the very first black churches, independent churches, which happened to have been Baptists. The first black church that we know anything about was built at Silver Bluff, South Carolina, in 1753, according to Whitson and Frazier. But when I took my team there several years ago and spent 3 weeks researching this one church, looking at the county records, looking at the graveyards, and interviewing the old people, it became clear that this church was much older than Woodson had thought, and that it may date back to 1750 rather than 1773. But at any rate, the first black churches, independent churches, were Baptists. And although they were closely monitored by white overseers, they were the first organized black institutions. There were 35 black Baptist churches in the state of Virginia alone by the time of the Civil War. The first black denomination was the African Methodist Episcopal denomination, which dates back to 1784 or 1797, depends upon how you read it, and which grew out of an independent black Methodist church, Mother Bethel, in Philadelphia. The next black denomination was the African Methodist Episcopal Zion Church, which originated in New York City and became a denomination in 1820. Both the African Church and African Zion Church grew out of disputes in the white churches over the issue of segregation that long ago. Your people were simply unhappy with being segregated in God's house, so they withdrew. The next denomination, the CME Church, grew out of the Methodist Episcopal Church South. When blacks from the two northern churches, AMEs and AME Zions, following the armies of the Union during the Civil War, made great raids into the white churches of the South, which had black auxiliary members, exhorting those blacks to come out of the segregated white churches and to join on to your own, be African. There were some Africans, some black people, in the Methodist Church South who did not want to affiliate with these African churches. And incidentally, though these two denominations bear the name African, it was very popular at that time for most of the black churches to include African in their names. Even then, we were trying to pay tribute to our origins. For example, the First African Church of Savannah, which grew out of the Silver Bluffs Church. And for example, the Abyssinian Baptist Church in New York. What these folk were trying to do was to say, we are African. We are proud of it. The CMEs had some misgivings about that. Their argument was that we are going to have to stay here in the South with these white folk, and we need to make arrangements to get along with them. It's a prudent kind of approach. So instead of walking out as did the two other African churches. Those who were to become the CME Church petitioned the Methodist Church South to permit them to demit. The Methodists were very happy that this request had been made, because the war is over now, and they were not about to permit the African Methodists in their church to have the same sort of status as they had. And yet, it has to be said that there were close ties between some of these blacks and some of these whites that had existed for many years, so there was a sort of feeling of mutual responsibility. So the white Methodists said, if by the time of the meeting of the next quadrennium, as you know, the Methodists meet every 4 years, which would be 1870, you have a sufficient number of annual conferences, which is to say a sufficient number of individual black churches, we will consider your request. 1870 came, and the blacks in the Southern Methodist Church had 8 annual conferences, 8 churches in Arkansas, Tennessee, Alabama, so on. And so the whites meeting in New Orleans did permit the blacks, or those who wanted to withdraw with their blessing, or as they put it, without prejudice, and lent them a bishop, as far as that is concerned, to help them get organized at Jackson, Tennessee in 1870. They did organize as the Colored Methodist Episcopal Church, very studiously and very deliberately avoiding the use of the word African. As a matter of fact, the official title was the Colored Methodist Episcopal Church in America. And there was an understanding between the blacks who went out of the white church that they would not become a political body. In return, the Southern Methodists expressed a sort of benign interest in the CME Church for years, probably still does. Gave them a very good college, Payne Seminary, Payne College down in Georgia, which, by the way, was the last black college in the country to give up its white president. But nevertheless, this is the history of these three Methodist groups. Now, and as you know, in 1954, the Colored Methodist Episcopal Church became the Christian Methodist Episcopal Church. And somewhere along the line, they dropped the latter part of the name in America. I don't know if it were officially dropped, if they simply stopped using it. That gave you three Methodist denominations, two that were based in the North, one that was based in the South. The Baptists, who had been the first to organize individual churches in what became what Jim Washington, the Baptist historian, calls a frustrated fellowship, because they were unable to hang together long enough to form a denomination, though they tried several times, so, until finally in 1895 in Atlanta, Georgia, they put together a coalition that held the National Baptist, the National Baptist Group. This group split in 1916, and you got the National Baptist Convention in America. So then you had two. The third Baptist division came in our own time, so that now you have the National Baptist Convention Incorporated, the National Baptist Convention in America, and the Progressive National Baptist Convention. Six major black denominations. The other one, the seventh one, is the Church of God in Christ. The Church of God in Christ has the unique distinction of being the only black church which did not have white roots. Church of God in Christ came out of the Azusa Street Holiness Revival held in Los Angeles for 2 years, between 1906 and 1908, where the preaching of William Seymour eventuated into something called the third blessing, the blessing by fire, which the baptism by fire, which loosely translated is the ability to speak in tongues. Charles Mason, who was a Baptist minister down in Lexington, Mississippi, like many, many others across America and even from as far away as France and Australia, came to Azusa Street to hear the preachings of Seymour and to receive the baptism by fire. Mason subsequently organized the Church of God in Christ, the first Pentecostal church, and became its first bishop, who subsequently ordained all of the white bishops who were ordained at the time. And so then that we have the unique experience of a black church being the father to some very substantial white churches, such as the Assemblies of God, for example. And that gives those seven major black denominations were the basis with which we worked, from which we worked in the creation of this study. Those seven denominations do not exhaust, of course, all of the black denominations, but they are the seven major denominations which have national constituencies. There are many other smaller black denominations. And there are, of course, blacks who belong to white denominations, the largest being the Catholics. There are somewhere between 1 7/10 and 1 9/10 million blacks in the Roman Catholic Church. The next largest white denomination, which has blacks in it, is the United Methodist Church, which has somewhere around 750,000. The other mainland denominations share the rest of that 14%, not in the seven major black denominations. So that is at least a profile of how we came to be where we are at this moment in terms of the black church. What I have tried to do is to sketch in for you some elements of antecedents that you may not have considered before, in the hope that you yourselves will not only be proud of your heritage, but that you will, through prodigious study and research, extend that heritage. That's a very fine book, but we have only scratched the surface. Thank you. If there are questions, you...
Okay, we're going to take a few moments for questions that you might want to direct to Dr. Lincoln. The first one, I might get it started by asking Dr. Lincoln to say something about the advantages that he observes in the black church, of the black church today, as we get ready to go into the 21st century, and the disadvantages.